KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland unless otherwise noted. The next engineering committee will meet Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m.
Thank you, baby. I just wanna take a little time out. Thank you, baby.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for contributing to KABU's membership drive. It was a success. And we couldn't have done it without you.
Thank you for your post, for your like, for your click. Thank you for your love, for your care, for your kind.
Thank you.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we spend the hour with women's rights and anti-racist campaigner and author, Selma James. Among her many contributions, Selma James founded the International Wages for Housework campaign and is the international coordinator of the Global Women's Strike. Selma coined the term unwaged, which has now been generally accepted into the language. She joined us in studio. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The House Judiciary Committee will consider amendments today to the two articles of impeachment that were announced Tuesday against President Trump regarding his actions toward Ukraine. The specific charges aimed at removing Trump from office include abuse of power and obstruction of Congress. Pennsylvania Democratic Congresswoman Madeline Dean sits on the Judiciary Committee.
I'm very mindful that we're here for just a short period of time, but we must be caretakers and stewards of this place and of our oath and of our Constitution. And in the face of the extraordinary wrongdoing of this president, seeking for personal and political gain, interference in our elections, risking our national security, nothing could be more grave.
President Trump headed to Pennsylvania for a re-election campaign rally Tuesday, where he called the effort impeachment light and promised it would lead to his re-election in 2020.
The impeachment hoax is about overturning your great 2016 vote, or in the alternative, trying to win the 2020 election. That's not going to happen.
The Judiciary Committee is expected to vote in a matter of days. The full House is expected to take the matter up by Christmas. If approved, it heads to the Senate, where it's likely to be rejected by the Republican majority. Department of Justice Inspector General Michael Horowitz testifies today at the Senate Judiciary Committee on his report on the conduct of FBI investigations during the Russia probe. Horowitz released his report on the investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election on Monday and concluded that the agency's investigation was authorized. This contradicts President Trump and his allies' insistence that the investigation was unjustified and probably unlawful. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, spoke with CBS.
After it started, it got to be criminal quick. It started maybe legally, but quickly became criminal. I doubt if Horowitz is going to say withholding exculpatory information from the court is okay.
The long-awaited report issued Monday rejected theories and criticism spread by Trump and his supporters, but it also found what it called serious performance failures up the FBI's chain of command that Republicans are citing as evidence that Trump was targeted by an unfair investigation. The review by Inspector General Horowitz finds that it was properly opened and that the law enforcement leaders were not motivated by political bias. The U.S. Education Department has released a new policy that will provide full loan forgiveness to students who are cheated by their colleges only if they earn far less than their peers. Others will receive relief between 25% and 75% of their debt. The policy is a departure from the Obama administration, which provided full loan forgiveness in cases of fraud. It also marks the second time the Trump administration has attempted to provide only partial loan relief. A federal court blocked a previous attempt in 2018 after it determined the Education Department violated privacy laws to gather income information. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said the new policy provides a fair resolution to the, what she called, mess inherited from the previous administration. However, Career Education Department staffers disagreed with DeVos's assertions. It's the last day of the UK's general election campaign. The latest polling shows the ruling Conservative Party could gain a majority, but the opposition Labour Party has been surging. A hung parliament remains a possibility. FSN's Stuart Smith reports from London.
UK party leaders are across the country in a last-ditch attempt to secure support in marginal seats, and the two main parties are sticking to their strongest tried and tested lines. Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party is warning the National Health Service is at risk from a Conservative government, and the Conservative Party, led by Prime Minister Boris Johnson, is sticking to its message of get Brexit done. Mr Corbyn is looking to pick up undecided voters, while at this stage Mr Johnson simply needs not to slip up. The Scottish National Party and Liberal Democrats are predicted to make only very modest gains. But with 85 lawmakers defending a margin of 5% or less since the last election, a surprise result is not out of the question. Stuart Smith, London.
Half of California's Catholic diocese expect to be subpoenaed by the state attorney general as part of an investigation into whether they have properly handled allegations of sexual abuse by priests. A church spokesman says the subpoenas are expected for the six dioceses that have already been providing documents since May. They are Los Angeles, San Francisco, Sacramento, Fresno, San Jose, and Orange. Attorney General Javier Becerra's office sent letters to all 12 dioceses in May, asking them to retain documents related to the abuse allegations that have forced the church to pay hundreds of millions of dollars to victims. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
That was our news headlines. Our guest is Selma James.
Thank you very much.
And I should say welcome yet again to Sojourner Truth.
I'm delighted to be back.
Selma James is a women's rights and anti-racist campaigner and author from 1958 to 1962. She worked with CLR James in the movement for West Indian Federation and Independence, and West Indies, of course, known as the Caribbean region. In 1972, she founded the Wages for Housework campaign, and in 2000 helped launch the Global Women's Strike, whose strategy for change is invest in caring, not killing. She coined the word unwaged, which has since entered the English language. In the 1970s, she was the first spokeswoman of the English Collective of Prostitutes. She is a founding member of the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network and co-authored the classic book, The Power of Women and the Subversion of the Community, which launched the domestic labor debate. Other publications include A Woman's Place in 1952, Women, the Unions and Work, or What is Not to be Done in 1972, Sex, Race and Class in 1974, Wageless of the World, also 1974, The Rapist Who Pays the Rent in 1982, The Ladies and the Mammies, Jane Austen and Jean Rhys in 1983, Marx and Feminism, also in 1983, Hookers in the House of the Lord, 1983, Strangers and Sisters, Women, Race, and Immigration, that was in 1985, The Global Kitchen for the Case for Counting Unwaged Work, 1985, and yet again in 1995, and The Milk of Human Kindness, Defending Breastfeeding from the AIDS Industry and the Global Market in 2005, and now, of course, the anthology. So, Selma James, you've been really busy. I don't know where you find the time for all of this and also the level of activism that you do. And indeed, that's some of what we're going to want to talk with you about, because as the movement now for change is picking itself up, people are very, very interested actually in organizing and in issues like autonomy and an organization outside of political parties. And have you found a similar experience in the UK as well?
Well, first of all, I found it on this tour. I was really very taken with the fact that people are much less rigid than they were even a year ago, mm-hmm. and much more open to all new ideas. But particularly, they don't want to know so much why. They want to know how. How do you do it? This is what we want to do. What's the best way of doing that? What's the most effective way? How can we get the most people involved? Who should we go to get involved? These are the questions, it seems to me, that are on people's lips that concern them. And they're the most important questions, because if you're working out how to do something, you're also working out why, and you're making connections with all kinds of people and all kinds of issues. That's what I found traveling the U.S. even more than in the U.K. Pardon me. These questions are arising in the U.K., but in the U.S., they are just widespread and eager and with a great deal of energy behind them. It was really very satisfying, this tour was.
Yes, and hopefully we'll be able to get to some of those questions, but I'm sure our listeners would be very interested in just getting some basic background information. You hail out of Brooklyn, New York.
I do.
A family that was very political, and you ended up in Los Angeles. Tell us a little about that.
Well, the 1930s is much underrated. It was a massive movement, and there was nobody in the neighborhood who was not in some way or another connected in a political way. Their sympathies were very strong for Republican Spain and for the formation of trade unions and for the unemployed to get a good chance, and for people not to be put on the street when they couldn't pay their rent. And my mother was very keen on those in particular and really helped families. And she was 5 foot nothing and would tell me later on how she herself moved the icebox in. I mean, the icebox clearly predates the fridge. Whereas my father was very involved in trade unions and involved in trying to get a Teamsters union in Brooklyn, and he was soon up against the mafia. That's who acted for the bosses. That's who were the enemy.
Yeah, right. So as a child of a very political household, and then you graduated from Erasmus Hall High School. You never really went to university.
No, I passed the exam. Brooklyn College was ready to take me. And I said, look, do I really want to ruin my mind by going to university? And I decided against it. I had met people who'd gone to university, and they were very arrogant, and I was afraid that that's what would happen to me. So I didn't go. I got married. I had a child. I worked, you know, to hold my end up in factories and as a waitress and all the jobs that people do when they first start into the labor market.
Yeah, so tell us then about the political work and the organization of C.L.R. James. C.L.R. James, that name will be known to our audience, a man from Trinidad in the Caribbean, and best known likely for his work on the Haitian Revolution, Black Jacobins. And C.L.R. James, see, everybody calls him C.L.R., was based in Los Angeles at the time that you were here. And there was an organization called the Johnson Forest Tendency. Tell us a bit about the work of that organization and why also it was called a tendency.
Right. I joined a youth group of a Trotskyist organization, and that's when I first heard about C.L.R. I had met him, in fact, much younger because my sister was doing some work for him, but there was no political association at all. He was just this very old man. He must have been in his late 30s. And this looked to me like ancient. But when I joined the youth group,
you were a teenager at the time.
Absolutely. Yeah, a young teenager. By the time I was 15, I had made my mind up that I wanted to be part of a political movement. I wanted to change the world. Everybody did in 1945, you know. The bomb had just dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we wanted completely a change. We wanted to overthrow capitalism, and I was set out to do that. And I met him, or at least I saw him from the public platform, and I saw him debating, and I saw him debating the Trotskyists, and I didn't understand a lot about what he was saying or what they were saying. But what I did understand was that he believed that working class people like myself were ready to do it and were going to do it, and the others didn't. So I said, well, I'm with him, because I definitely felt that I was going to do it and that other people I knew would. And then I understood, little by little, really, that what he was talking about and what he was bringing people together for was really to build a movement and to acknowledge the particular experiences of different people. For example, he said something talking about black people, that the Negro movement, as it was called then, had an independent validity, which meant that whether working class people, white or black, were interested in being in that movement took primacy. That movement could not be crossed, could not be scabbed on. And that was my earliest training on
kind of autonomy.
It was autonomy, mm-hmm. although it was not called that then. Mm-hmm. And when I went to him because somebody urged me to go in the organization and tell him about what I thought about housewives and my neighbors and the things they were thinking and doing, he was tremendously excited by that and told me I had to write a pamphlet. One of the things that I remember telling him was that I had my son must have been a year or two old, and I walked into my friend's house, and she had her children's clothes. She had two or three kids across the living room, hanging on pegs, and I thought she was insane, and I said, "Well, why are you doing this?" And she said, "I'm selling them."
Hmm.
And I looked puzzled. She said, "Look, if I don't get any money of my own, I'm going to go mad. So this is what I'm doing." And it made a great impression on me because there was nothing wrong with that woman. And there was a lot right in what she was saying. And I told him that and other things like that. And it was like a whole sector of the world all of a sudden became visible to him. He was very excited, as I say, with what I was reporting, and he told me to do this pamphlet.
And is that a woman's place then?
Well, yes.
Did it become a woman's place
in
1952?
It did, but then he called me some months later,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "Have you done the pamphlet?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Why not?" I said, "Because I don't know how to write a pamphlet." He said, "It was very easy." He said, "You just take a shoebox and you put a slit at the top, and every time you think of something, you put the sentence on a piece of paper and put it in the shoebox. Then one day you open the shoebox and put the sentences together, and you'll have a pamphlet."
Hmm.
And I did that, and I did have a pamphlet. It took me from 8 in the morning to about 7 or 8 at night, and the pamphlet was there. It was a very good draft, hardly changed later to what we see today.
That's an amazing story. Also very encouraging, I'm sure, for people who want to write and have that urge to get their ideas down. We're going to go to a music break, and we'll be right back with women's rights and anti-racist campaigner and author Selma James. She has a new book out, The Must Read, Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning. It is an anthology of her writings from 1952 to 2011. We'll be right back.
It's complicated when you gravitate towards yourself. On the other hand, it's hard to talk to anyone else. You can't help when your mind goes.
Welcome back. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And again, I'm speaking with Selma James. She is with me in studio. Her anthology just published, Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings, 1952 to 2011. It was prefaced by Marcus Rediker, an introduction by Nina Lopez, and published by PM Press. So, Selma James, one of the things I wanted to ask you about with the Johnson Forest tendency is that we know that there were splits going on, among left organizations at the time. There were the Stalinists, there were people who followed Trotsky, and a lot of people have talked about the Johnson Forest tendency as really creating new ground from the perspective of what has been described by Marcus Rediker and others as working class self-activity, and what we have come to know today as autonomy, and also of making a critique against what was happening in the Soviet Union. Just tell us a bit about the role of Johnson Forest and that important when we look at what's happening now of the movements today as people are trying to find their way to self-activity and to autonomy.
Well, CLR had come to this country because he was invited by Trotskyists to lecture. He was an important person in the European movement. He was anti-imperialist, pan-African, and he was a student of Marxism, trying to find out. This is the 1930s, you know. Hitler took power in 1933. He had come to be a writer. But you can't be a writer if Hitler's in power. You have to think of what you're going to do with your life and how you're going to oppose this thug and this power. And when he came to the U.S., he, of course, came to Trotskyism. And he began to know working class people in this country, black people generally, and black working class people in particular. And he was really taken with how mobile we were in the U.S. He was always stunned at the fact that we could get up and in Los Angeles, and in a couple of 3 days we'd driven across country without having made a great arrangement to do that. We were very mobile. We were very able to change in a way that Europeans had not been. And he saw that the left parties, first of all, the Trotskyist parties, were not aware of how much abilities we had and how much we wanted to change things, because we didn't do it in the European way. We didn't form a Labour Party, for example, but at any moment you could have wildcat strikes and really challenge to power in the United States. Mm-hmm. As for the Stalinists, they were, in his view, and of course in mine, mass murderers. And now we know that that's who they were. That's been exposed. But what Trotskyism had in common with Stalin, that's right, what they had in common was that they both believed that working class people, in order to make change, had to take the leadership of a party, of a vanguard party. And James, who was called Johnson, by the way, that was his party name, he said, not at all. This party is behind where working class people are. And working class people can throw up their own leadership and have always in the past. And, you know, his training was really crucially the training of the black Jacobins in Haiti, and how slaves had got together, had confronted Napoleon, had confronted other European armies, and had been able to do it with hardly anything at their disposal. They did it with their bare hands and with their organization and with the leader that they found, and no doubt other leaders that are less well known. And if it can happen to people who had nothing, well, why couldn't it happen to people who had a little more than nothing? People in the United States who had cars and telephones and typewriters. Now, of course, we have computers. And he had absolutely, he said, what the Vanguard Party had done was to really step on people, was to really keep them down and repressed. And it's really what the movement now is addressing to. What kind of an organization do you want to make that does not repress the movement it says it speaks for? So that's what we were tackling, not as a party, but as a tendency. That explains that question you asked earlier on. Yeah. Yes, Johnson was CLR James. Forrest was Raya Donayevskaya. The third person who was in the leadership was Grace Chin Lee. So here was a woman of Chinese descent, a woman who came from Russia, and a man, a black man from the West Indies. They were the leadership of the tendency. Now, that's a bit different from what you find every day of the week.
Absolutely.
And, and we were also international in our outlook, anti-imperialist as well as anti-racist and anti-sexist, a lot before many organizations were, or I think any. And we were going somewhere and learning about the world from the point of view of how it looks at the bottom rather than looking down. And that was really the way to find out how the world really is.
Right, and likely what CLR James meant by every cook can govern. So fast forwarding a bit then, you left the United States. CLR basically had to leave. This was during a very repressive time, the McCarthy period, et cetera, moved to the UK. and you became his wife.
We did.
Yeah. And you spent some time in the UK and then also in the Caribbean region, where you worked along with CLR on the whole issue of the Federation and independence, the independence movement from the colonial powers, really at a high point then in the Caribbean as well as in Africa. So we're just kind of fast forwarding a bit to give our listeners some sense of the range of work and movements that you have been involved in. So, and also in the anti-racist movement in the UK. You were Force Organizing Secretary, what was the name of the campaign against racial discrimination? Just briefly touch on that, because then I do want to get to your developing this coining this term unwage work and what you mean.
Right. Well, in 1964-65, Martin Luther King came to England. And he spoke to all of us, to a number of people who were gathered together, who people knew were anti-racist. And they talked about forming an organization and that we would have a meeting to form an organization. And CLR got up and he said, let's form it now. Now, that was typical of him. There's no point to having a meeting to have a meeting.
Yeah.
Let's right now. And they said, okay, and a number of us came together and formed the core, which is what you always have to begin with, and we formed a campaign against racial discrimination, which had to deal with many West Indian people and people and Indian people from India and Pakistan.
So these were people of Afro descent and people from India.
These are, yes, Afro and
from
Indo descent from the Caribbean, and then Indian people from the subcontinent,
yeah.
Indian and Pakistani people who had come as immigrants and who were the subject of great racism, not on the street only, but by employers and by people who were renting houses and by the police. And we were running from pillar to post, you know, this case and that case and the other case. You know how it goes.
Yeah.
And as we came together, first of all, we came together across those boundaries, those racial boundaries, and we educated white people and began to take up the cases that were, you know, that were really repressing and suppressing and oppressing people of color. And people then used the word, at first they began by using the word colored, so that you would not distinguish between people of color who were of African and or of Indian descent. But then later, the whole movement used the word black, and everybody who was a person of color called themselves black. And it was a great unifying force, which lasted for a lot of years, in fact, until Thatcher came to power, which meant that we were unified across racial boundaries. There was autonomy within that unity. That is, there would be organizations of people of largely Afro or Indo descent, but we were all together. And that was a great power, and it enabled us to fight immigration cases because, of course, there was question of this one being deported and that one being deported, and to prevent people from going to prison, or if they were, to help them to get out and to keep the violence of the extreme right at bay.
Yeah.
All of these were jobs that the movement had to do. And the unions were so racist, it was unbelievable. I mean, we had to educate them not to discriminate against their members who were people of color, women or men.
Yeah, yeah. I'm speaking with Selma James. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Selma James is in studio. She is on here in the U.S. She is based in London, England. Her anthology, Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings, 1952 to 2011. Of course, Selma James, in 1972, it is said about the book that you set out new political perspective, and that your starting point was the millions of unwaged women who, working in the home and on the land, were not seen as workers and their struggles viewed as outside of the class struggle. So fast forwarding now, you were deeply embroiled anti-racist work, the anti-colonial period here in the United States, the work you did publishing in 1952, A Woman's Place. So we're fast forwarding now to the rise, the coming up of the women's movement, yes, on the heels of the civil rights movement and the welfare rights movement. And you founded the Power of Women Collective, which then became the Wages for Housework campaign. But tell us, with the classic work, the book Power of Women and the Subversion of the Community, what were you hoping, what did you set out to do with putting forward this political perspective and also in coining the term unwaged, which has now kind of become, has become part of the language?
Well, first of all, it seemed to me that if you have a women's movement and are continually outlining all the ways in which women are discriminated against and often persecuted, and the violence that we suffer, and the refusal of the state to enable us to make our own decisions about reproduction, all of this, was it because men are evil and could not be changed? They're just wicked. Or because women are foolish and allow these things? And once I certainly began to look at what was women's relationship to the economy, mm-hmm, and to capitalism and to the powers that be, what I could see immediately was that women made the basic capitalist commodity, and that was labor power. If men went out and if women went out and asked for some employer, please exploit me, which is what we do every day, well, who is that person going out? Did they just grow like a flower, or were they 9 months in the womb, many years of worry, concern, care, education, nursing, you know what mothers do. And was that person, when he or she confronted the employer, what was peculiar about that work was that it was not considered as work. And the reason that it wasn't was, first of all, because women did not get any payment for it. So it wasn't considered work. And a man could come home at the end of the day and say, what did you do all day? And you could say, well, I washed the diapers, and I did this, and I did that, and I did the other, and I did the other. But that's not really
work. But he was the real worker.
Yes, he was the worker, because he brought the money in at the end of the week. And when you went out to work, they told you you're working for pin money and you don't have to have pay equity. And it was clearly because women lacked social power, because what they were doing was not recognized by the market. We began to understand that this question of a split between those who are waged, those who had a bit of money, not much, and those who are unwaged, who had nothing to call their own, that split existed in the whole world, that most of the world was unwaged, even men. In many countries of the world, women's unwaged work is the economy. There isn't hardly anything else but what women will produce in the way of food, clothing, shelter. You know, you go to Africa, you see the women building the houses there. So what is this economy? So, you know, and when the banks came and took all that money, we said, you see that? What the banks have is really important, but what we don't have doesn't matter.
We're going to take a station break, and when we return, we'll continue our conversation with women's rights and anti-racist campaigner and author Selma James, who has a book out, Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, an anthology of her writings from 1952 to 2011. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and I'm speaking with Selma James, London-based Selma James. She recently spoke at a teach-in that had the title Sex, Race, and Class in it. Actually, what are the terms of unity? And I would like to now get to some of the pressing and burning questions of the movement today, and starting off actually with a question that came up at the teach-in, where someone, a young woman, asked about the caring of children and whether or not you would, the Wages Faster campaign, of course, the global women's strike began. We're missing a lot of that history with the unifying theme of invest in caring, not killing, and being fiercely anti-war. But she raised the question of the collective caring of children. Is that what you are putting forward? You talked about the importance of the bonding between a mother and a child in those formative years. And the question is, can this also be done in a collective setting as opposed to just the mother and the child?
Well, I think it's absolutely wonderful for it to be in a collective setting. And I don't think that anybody should be isolated by the fact that they want to be with their child and that their child wants to be with them. And I think, first of all, even before we get to the collective generally, we have to get to the father who wants to be involved. I mean, it's a tremendous bonus for the child, but it's also what I believe is a civilizing influence for men. You know, the idea that you give yourself to another human being is a wonderful experience for you and a wonderful experience for the human being who is receiving your love. And it is lasts for a child's life. I don't think any of us feel we gave enough time to our children, because most of the time we had a job to do or we had to make a little money go a long way, which was a lot of work. And we never were able to say, well, I don't have to worry about money. Not too many people can say that. I just want to concentrate on making a home for my child and on developing the relationship, on breastfeeding, and on my child making contact with other children and other adults, you know, making a big experience in her life or his. I don't think that we want to ignore or neglect that. Our children and we and our relationships has to be the center of production. And if production doesn't suit our children, then we have to abolish that part of it. You know, I wrote an article for The Guardian about a year and a half ago, and one of the things I said was that as the UK government was making cuts in welfare and resources to especially to poorest people, but to all of us, that that was a way of saying that the reproduction of the human race was plunging as a social priority. Yeah. That is, the human beings didn't matter. Well, to hell with that. You know, we don't want that. We don't want a society where the human being is not central. And I don't mean central so that it's at the expense of animals and others who want to live on this planet. I mean central as against the machine and the profit-making and the market and the wars and the governments and the elite who live off the work that we do. We women, we men, and we children. There are a lot of children in the world who work a 12, 14-hour day also in order to survive.
Also, in your work, the autonomy of sectors of people are integral. For example, you were the first spokeswoman for the English Collective of Prostitutes. They chose a non-sex worker to be a spokesperson to be able to give some credibility and get the message out to the press. But also, lesbian women, there's now Queer Strike, that's part of it, les, bi, gay, trans people. There's women with visible and invisible disabilities, Payday Men's Network, women of color, etc. So in the work that you have done over the years in working with this international, one could see in a very practical way the, you know, you're not only talking about traditional relationships between men and women.
Absolutely. And mm-hmm. we don't even know what our sexual identity is going to be. I think we're in a period of flux. We're just looking to find out what our sexual possibilities are, not merely for a thrill, but to express ourselves as individuals and as very social human beings. Each of the sectors, as you say, is independent, autonomous within the global women's strike, which we began, which the Wages for Housework began, and which guides it from 2000. And we have single mother self-defense, women with disabilities, other women and men who put forward their own needs. And to the degree that others are paying attention, to that degree they see their own connection with the demands and needs of other sectors. You know, when the Wages Due Lesbians, which became Queer Strike, began, and we all discussed it, lesbian and non-lesbian women. And I remember one woman saying, well, let's face it, we're all lesbian. We all have closer relationships with women than we do with men. Even if we sleep with men, we tell our secrets to another woman. And I was deeply impressed by that because it was true. As we destroy that power relation between women and men, our possibilities open, not close. And we don't know what we're going to want.
Right. And that question of autonomy and also of giving voice, making visible the power relations among us, the way in which we're divided in society by economic background, national boundaries, you know, et cetera, brings us then to the question that very much at the forefront of movements today in the Occupy movement, a lot of young people in the Zapatista movement as well, of putting forward the analysis or attempting a practice of what's called horizontalism. And I'm wondering, you know, can the practice of horizontalism undermine those divisions and for, you know, the divisions among us, and also for those who are committed to horizontalism as an ideal, as many people are, what kind of encouragement or advice can you offer on this?
When you know, when we had a big demonstration in London, November 30th, a lot of workers were coming out on strike because their pensions were being cut. And the whole of Occupy London, the stock exchange at St. Paul's Cathedral in London, joined this march. And they had a kind of scaffolding. And at the very top, it said, all power to the 99%. And I said, but this is fantastic. You know, I was really for all power to the 99%. And that might lead you to horizontalism. That is, we all are we as one, as you say in Trinidad. On the other hand, we're not. On the other hand, we are the different sectors. On the other hand, we bring the power relations among us to whatever we organize, and therefore we must organize against those power relations. And saying that we are all the same sometimes hides our differences and doesn't bring our attention to organizing against them. That's my problem with horizontalism, in the sense that we all want to be together and we all want to have equal opportunity, but we don't all have that. And we therefore have to organize together against the disparities of power among us. I'm very convinced that the disparities of power among us are exactly what keeps capitalism going. Capitalism is the disparities of power among people on an international level. We want to destroy those disparities. We don't want power among us. But you don't get rid of power by just dismissing it. You get rid of power by addressing it, by knowing everything about it, and by fighting to undermine these disparities among us. I think that I'm not giving a solution. There isn't one. look for ways of undermining the disparities of power, because we begin to see what the differences are between us and how we have to show solidarity among us and undermine the habits of power. And also, we have to know how much leadership we are getting from sectors who are less powerful than we are. You know, one
what
of
do you
my,
mean by that?
Oh, well, I mean, first of all, what a great education I've got working with prisoners.
You've worked with Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I worked with Mumia, and I'm starting to work with Maroon, Russell Schultz Jr., who's been inside for 40 years. He was a Black Panther and is being persecuted for that. And the amount, what they understand and what they have been able to organize inside under the most dreadful circumstances is not only excites the imagination, but gives you a lot of courage and a lot of hope. Because people always do rebel, and people always do organize, and I've seen women in Uganda, for example, also who have walked 3 days with a baby on their back, with very little food, in order to be together, in order to be connected with us in England and with you all in the United States, to have an international mobilization and to be able to make demands on the Ugandan government as a result of the power that they have organized and the connections that they have organized. And I've seen so many times that people organize who have nothing, but they find a way to get together and to just to exercise a bit of power and to make their case. They used to use the United Nations for that, you know, during the UN decade for women, making their case, expressing their needs, asking others for help, and ready to help others as well. You know, there is, this is the kind of activity that it seems to me builds really a unified and very, very powerful movement. And I think we're on the verge of something like that now. I think the whole question of horizontalism and how you organize is really very close to that movement bursting out.
Yes, and on that note, looking at what we're facing right now, you know, we see the shooting of this young man, Trayvon Martin Young, 17-year-old teenager, and his characters being malign, and he was his body drug tested, et cetera, while the shooter, none of that happened. So also when we look at the data, we see that poor Black women today are just about where they were, if not poorer than a decade ago. It's not to say that we haven't made some gains, yes, but we have also lost some ground. And integral in that discussion about how movements get diverted has been the role of non-governmental organizations, right, have been the role of foundations and funders that have such an impact into the direction and demands of movements.
Well, it is quite extraordinary how much of the movement has become NGO-ized, where, you know, what we've found in the UK, for example, that Black Women's Rape Action Project and Women Against Rape, two organizations at our Crossroads Women's Center in London, are active with rape victims, are active including with women asylum seekers, for example, from Africa who have been raped in Africa and come for asylum. And there are no others. What happened to the anti-rape movement? Well, the anti-rape movement is giving counseling. The anti-rape movement is meeting with the police. But the anti-rape movement, so-called, is not making demands on the police, is not saying you must catch the rapist as a priority. And then when you say, well, why haven't you? They tell you that we're fighting terrorism. Isn't terrorism what the rapist does to the woman? You know, we see that they have got funded to do counseling. They have got funded to meet with the police. But nobody's ready to fund them to confront the police and to demand that they get justice. And that has happened across the board with the women's movement. Women have become part of the elite. you see often the tobacco companies and other criminal corporations, they get a woman to front for them. And then you have non-governmental organizations which are formed, which don't fight for what the movement demanded that they fight for. And nobody seems to, they're ready to fund people who will fight for abortion, but they're not ready to fund people who will fight for pay equity, which is a woman's right. The first right is you get paid what a man gets paid for doing the job that a man does, or the actual equivalent.
But surely the right to abortion, which is so under attack right now, I mean, has to be defended.
Absolutely. It must be defended. It is our right to control our own fertility, but it's also our right to get pay equity. And the fact is that...
And for resources to have children.
And indeed, this is a really crucial question, which sometimes the abortion movement has not taken into consideration, that sometimes we have an abortion because we don't have money to have the child. And so I think that we have to look again at how funders, foundations, and governments have guided, in fact, led our movement via NGOs. We're going to look at that, and we're going to howl very loud about that passing as a movement, which is merely an expression of capitalist power.
And we have literally 1 minute. I can't believe how the time has flown. Final comment on the importance of what is happening in Haiti for all of us.
Well, I'm amazed sometimes at how people in the United States, especially people of color, are not deeply committed, openly and overtly doing stuff to help the Haitian people. What they did was to begin the civilization of the Americas by ending slavery for the first time in 1804 in the Americas, and they have fought from then to now for their liberation. They have great resilience, and they have great determination, and all of us have a responsibility to the Haitian people to back what they are doing in spite of what the Clintons are doing and the Duvalier people are doing and the French are doing. Everybody has been, you know, they are impertinent, the black people in Haiti. They just demand their leadership and will not take no for an answer. Let's back them.
All righty. On that note, we are out of time. Selma James in the United States with her new anthology, Sex, Race, and Class, The Perspective of Winning, a selection of writings from 1952 to 2011. Selma James, thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I would love to hear from you. You could email me directly at mpkpfk@gmail.com. I'd love to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. If you would like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. You can follow us on Twitter at SoTrueKPFK or look for us on Facebook. Look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
This is KBOO Portland. Coming up is Hard Knock Radio, but first, this.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll show the documentary film The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. The Cave is a story of female doctors saving lives in a secret underground hospital in Syria. The film follows the women as they contend with daily bombardments, chronic supply shortages, and the ever-present threat of chemical attacks. It paints a stirring portrait of courage, resilience, and female solidarity. Again, that's The Cave on Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.